I just want to talk about the mirror tunnel. So like everything Matt said, yes, and that church specifically was, I guess you're gonna put some stuff on the website, but it was a synagogue that was then sold to a Black church in 52, which given the background of Oregon's redlining laws that were in effect at that time, if you were a person of color, it was written into the state constitution until I think it was like 2006 or something, don't quote me on that date, but very recently, that if you were a person of color in Oregon, you could be taken out to a square every year and flogged for owning property. And so redlining in Oregon was really not good. And so even kind of looking at that site as this alternative that was hosting people who were not, were otherwise denied their humanity during these times is actually really something to add in there and great. But there's these amazing installations that Matt's been working on over the past like 12 years that kind of come to live. You know, every Christmas does like a nativity, but it's really a huge like augmented reality VR endeavor, very abstract. The mirror tunnel does exist. It's like walking through an amazing kaleidoscope. I hope you don't like that one as much as Lava Lamp. You know, and that's like what your sort of point of entry is like you walk through into an alternate dimension, this like space, which is everything Matt just said it was and more, you know, and people perform there. There's poetry readings, talks, lectures. Also cats sometimes hang out there. We might just be working on something in there sometimes. I know I've been lucky enough to play there before as well. And there's a documentary that was Matt was a part of making. Y'all did that like 10 years ago, right?
So we filmed and have partially edited a documentary about repurposed churches. We're getting on tangents here, but I'm happy to take them. What Chloe said about the full history of the space is really important actually and informs the magnitude of this building, which I hope to see preserved and never destroyed, you know, for the sake of making three generic condos. But it did start as a synagogue. So there have been Jews, Christians, and artists who have inhabited this space over the years. And each of those categories of humans, you know, have been persecuted in their own ways, you know, are pushed to the margin in their own ways, some very obvious and some a little more subtle. But the quote that you mentioned, Matthew, is from the rabbis of the synagogue back around 1952, as Chloe said, when they had outgrown the space, they'd identified a new building that they'd like to move to, and they put this building on the market. And the neighborhood was predominantly white at the time, and they didn't want to see a Black church move in. And in fact, they petitioned the city. They put pressure on the real estate agent to, you know, don't sell them this Black church. And that quote is pulled from this amazingly well-penned letter from the rabbis written to the real estate agent, sticking up for virtues, common decency, and principles that would have been very progressive in 1952. And so they wound up selling to the Black church anyways, as that was their wish. And then for decades, it was a home to various Christian congregations. And so that's always a bit of history that I'm eager to share because it's important, it's kind of incredible. And that letter has been such a point of inspiration for me. You know, it continues to be a point of inspiration. It's like they did something radical, and there is this artifact that we have. And what might I do ultimately that could feel as radical and as important as the stand that they took. I'm not sure I've done that yet, you know, but I do know I've offered the space to the community, and it's been very generative, and I'm very proud and grateful for that. But I just wanted to kind of like, I mean, you know, happily take any other questions about this, but you know, to veer towards something a little more practical, back on the subject of the art that Chloe and I make, for example, and the virtualization of our practice. The mirror tunnel that Chloe mentioned is a large structure that is built of lumber and glass and LED lights and metal. And what I learned in making large-scale installation art over the years is it takes monetary resources, it takes person power, it leaves a disastrous wake of cumbersome material that you must then decide, do we dispose of this or do we store it? You know, what's its next destination? And so that was a huge motivator for me getting into virtual reality, is this kind of realization, wow, you can produce the same type of, you know, the same sense of physicality and place a user right in the middle of those sounds and architecture and not have to deal with all those aforementioned burdens, which are of course joyful, right? It's great to bring people together, work on a big project, but there's a burdensome aspect to it, and there's just sheer resources that you come up against. So that I think is one of the best things about digital art nowadays, is this possibility exists where we can move mountains in software with little twitches and movements of the fingers, and it can be incredibly lightweight.
My name is Matthew Raymond, and welcome to the first edition of MuTech Dialogues. This podcast miniseries aims to explore the conceptual arcs and creative rhythms that connect the diverse musicians, artists, and practitioners that make up the festival this year. For this episode, I sat down with Kieran Bumber and Nancy Lee to discuss their recent collaborative exhibition, Union. This multimedia work makes use of immersive installation, film, and sculpture to depict a dystopian but familiar world of lost intimacy and ecological disaster. Users are invited to engage with Gaia, a social media monolith which controls the totalizing cyber world and profits off the sale of experiences and memory. In response to this loss of the social, as an artwork, Union posits a deep sense of intergenerational memory that has the power to produce new rituals of connection. It was a fascinating and far-ranging conversation, and I hope you enjoy it. I wanted to begin by kind of just exploring your 2021 collaborative exhibition, Union. So this was kind of an experiment in full-fledged sci-fi world building. And I thought maybe we could just kind of begin by exploring the structure and kind of the parameters of this world. I was really fascinated by the kind of the way that you described the three distinct levels.
Yeah, so with the dystopic, you know, world, that is a representation of the current world that we already live in, the world in the flesh that we live in. And with a dystopian world in a union, people are no longer able to touch each other. People live indoors because of environmental degradation and air pollution. So this dystopian world kind of exists within year 3000. And in year 3000, people have lost all access to digitized archives from, you know, worldwide cyber warfare. So as humans, we no longer know where we come from. And in this dystopian world, the only way for humans to access any form of joy or pleasure is through accessing the cyber world, which is known as Gaia.
Right. And in terms of this access to the cyber world, like what kinds of experiences are simulated by the kind of the infrastructure of Gaia?
Yeah. So in Gaia, you're essentially, when you subscribe to Gaia, you are basically telling Gaia that your memories can be extracted. And Gaia then extracts everyone's memories, packages them up into experiences and levels. And every time you earn what the currency of Gaia is, which is called arcs, and the way you earn arcs is through this memory extraction. So we have a portion in the installation of the exhibition where people actually play what's called the memory game. And it's an interactive installation where people walk in to zones and a voice of Gaia is just simply asking you questions about your life. And so non-invasively, Gaia is extracting these memories, packages them up, and then resells them back to other people. And there's different levels of memory where you would experience even more pleasure and joy. And those levels are based on the names of our happy hormones, like serotonin, oxytocin, and whatnot.
That's fascinating. I think that does a good job of kind of describing the dystopic and then the kind of like simulated social kind of world that that Union explores. Is there, and then the third level, just to give the full kind of picture of the world that you've created around Union and around the theme of marriage and ritual. I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so essentially in this world, there is a resistance, because as we know, in any sort of dystopic world, there is a resistance that is trying to fight back. And this resistance has a knowledge of ancestry and the notion of ancestry and cultural memory. And so Gaia knows that, has some knowledge of how powerful that is, because the only memories that they can't extract is your cultural memory, and those get triggered through ritualistic performance. And so in this world, the two characters, Nancy and I, we do resist against Gaia, and we do enact this year 3000 sci-fi intercultural marriage ceremony, which lands us into this Union world where our bodies, you see our bodies for the first time in a space where we are permeated like with touch, and we're touching each other, and that is represented through a sculpture that is in the space.
That's amazing. I definitely want to go deeper into each of these kind of three layers of the world and explore some of the themes that they evoke. But first, I kind of wanted to ask from a process side, how did you go about giving each of these kind of layers their own distinct feeling in terms of the design and of the emotional kind of texture and content? Were there specific kind of methods that you used to come up with that, or to make sure that you evoked that in your participants?
Yeah, we did. We were very intentional in creating very clear worlds. You know, it was part of our world building process. And we worked under the mentorship of PM Massey, who is a film mentor of mine. And she kind of gave us some frameworks. You know, we mind mapped. We talked about the senses. We talked about the political and like philosophical ideas of each of the worlds. We talked about how each world, or how people perceive any of their senses in each of the worlds, and how, you know, what are the hopes and dreams, and what are the fears that people have within each of the worlds. So the world building process for us for this project actually took a very long time. And we kind of like wrote down all of the different ideas that kind of came to mind and used that to kind of create a very distinct, like art board, almost a visual and sonic mood board for each of the worlds. So we can kind of play with the cusp of the world. Because I think, you know, when it comes to world building, it's about straddling between the cusp of the different worlds and how that transition happens.
Mm, so you're saying you spent a fair amount of time focused on the various transitions between the worlds and how that kind of make the participants feel?
Yeah, so the cusp and also, well, obviously the world itself in terms of like, you know, the material quality of the world, you know, like in and the color palettes in the world, the sonic quality of the world, you know, like in dystopia, it's all these like black kind of plasticky kind of materials. And it's true because, you know, in this dystopian future, plastic is the only material we have access to. We don't have organic materials anymore. So thinking about like materiality and then thinking about like sonically what that sounds like as well too. And then, you know, building upon like, okay, the cyber world, what kind of color palette, what kind of branding would Gaia have? What typography would Gaia have? You know, what kind of voice would Gaia have? And then kind of building around that. And same with Union as well too. And then once we have the different worlds, then we started playing with the cusp. So it's like, how do you move from one world to the other? Because it's through exploring and traveling through the cusp, then that's where you really know you've transitioned from one world to another, and you can really tell the kind of difference within the world.
Yeah, and that's really interesting because those transition spaces are where perhaps like the political potentiality lies as well, right? Like mm-hmm. it's like, how do we transition from this kind of dystopic Gaia world to the world of Union, and what does that mean for like, how does that feel to step out away from the kind of mechanisms of capture that kind of outline those first two levels?
Yeah, exactly. I think with any kind of like science fiction, that's kind of like where I feel like that's kind of where like the interesting kind of like narrative elements kind of lie in terms of even like with storytelling. It's like, how and why are you transitioning from one world to the other? And like what story mechanism, what kind of, what about the characters is like driving them to transition between the world? Like what are the antagonistic forces that are forcing them to transition in the world?
It's so interesting. I'm glad that you also brought up in your previous answer the ad and the branding of Gaia, because I thought that was one of the most kind of like immersive and engaging pieces for me was looking at these Lightbox ads that you did. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about those and about the process behind making and conceptualizing them, and maybe a little bit about what you were trying to convey with the Lightbox.
One of the Lightboxes is the Arc. It says play, and there's like an arc logo in the middle. It's the yellow one. And we really want to be, you know, we kind of looked at all of like, you know, all like lottery ticket slogans and like casino slogans and things like that to really think like how we can kind of, because, you know, creating a slogan is also really important in world building. So in that light box, it says play, and it also says play the memory game. So for that particular light box, it's meant to kind of mimic, you know, what you would see in like casino advertisements, you know, at bus stops or like subway train stations. And it's really through the advertisements and the light boxes that we were able to kind of convey the kind of story element of Union, the Union universe. For the arc symbol, we've decided to call the arc symbol or the memory currency arc based on the arc protein that exists within our DNA. And there's a whole history about how the arc protein was like discovered. And essentially it's kind of like a virus that kind of infected, I think it was the mitochondria. I can't remember this actually. Totally.
Yeah, I think it was the mitochondria. Yeah.
Okay, it was the mitochondria. Okay. And it kind of like symbiotically like evolved together, and essentially what happened? Oh no, actually no, it wasn't the mitochondria. The mitochondria was another viral infection. Sorry, I have a biology background. I'm getting all my facts mixed up.
Amazing.
But essentially, the ARC protein codes for kind of like the recall of memory in the human body. And that protein segment actually came through. They theorize that it came through from like a viral infection of like biological cells, and it kind of just evolved like symbiotically.
Wow.
Until now we have this ability to recall memory.
Wow.
Yeah. And then the next one, we have a light box that says a deeper way to connect. And, you know, this light box kind of symbolizes like kind of like an advertisement to entice people to join the Gaia universe. And there's like some super small text at the bottom. Maybe you can see it in the image that we sent you. But it's pretty much talks about this like cyber neurological implant. And it's like a very easy procedure that you can get this cyber neurological implant kind of implanted in your like spine. And that is kind of like, that's kind of like the computer chip for us to access the cyber world. Like there's no, you know, VR headset, there's no like desktop computer or any kind of external, you know, devices. It's essentially just this like one little small chip that becomes implanted in your spine, sends like electric signals through like your nervous system, and that's how we actually access this cyber world Gaia. And the third advertisement is the advertisement that has the four pillars of enlightenment that has the text of like serotonin, dopamine, endorphin, and oxytocin. So essentially, these are the four pillars that you can kind of like level up on once you're in Gaia. So in order for you to level up, you have to gain arcs. So it's kind of like, you know, we were kind of basing the world building of this section kind of like multi-level marketing platforms. We were like taking language from that. And then also kind of like, you know, like in recent years, or maybe in recent decades, there has been a lot of I would say, you know, like self-development programs that maybe are not, you know, are kind of exploitative financially. Essentially, you pay to kind of level up within this like self-development like pyramid scheme or framework. So we kind of took a lot of, we studied kind of the language that they use for that, and we took a lot of that language and we incorporated into the voice of Gaia. But essentially, you know, with a lot of those, you know, if you've gone to any MLM like meeting by accident, you know the kind of tools that they use. It's usually by accident, right? You like roll in and you're like, oh my God. There's usually tools that they use in terms of like their language. And then also there's like a lot of like self-development kind of like, you know, groups and workshops, or even kind of in like spirituality. You know, there's a lot of this whole movement on like spiritual bypassing and things like that, where, you know, you pay money to become more spiritually enlightened, to, you know, to meditation camps, to do these things. So essentially that advertisement lightbox kind of like addresses like, you know, some of those elements of like the Gaia kind of world building, kind of using spiritual language and talking about, because a lot of that movement is kind of playing with, you know, our release of our happy hormones. But also, you know, this kind of is a reflection and, you know, commentary on like our current relationship to technology as well too, where we are addicted to social media because it gives us those same happy hormones every time we get a like, every time we get an engagement through our phones.
Yeah, and it's interesting that like what it seems like the function of Gaia in this world is to somehow replace or simulate what's missing from that first level of reality, like in the dystopia. Mm-hmm. And it does so in this very kind of transactional way, right? Like down to the decomposition of happiness, which is, you know, a felt sense or a holistic experience, into these kind of like neurological correlates that can then be parceled out and like turned into levels and basically pre-programmed in some way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's almost like, even today too, when you subscribe to an app, you know, it might be free, but nothing's free, right? So it's like your data is being collected and bought out by, you know, mass corporations and whatnot. So the idea is that, yeah, even in our world, you know, all the cyber world that we inhabit is giving us this pleasure that we may not feel in IRL.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. So based on the background that you've described of the process in this, it sounds like this wasn't an influence. But one of the things that I was wondering is whether there was a bit of a reflection on the whole role of cryptocurrency in the kind of past 5 years going on in the conceptualization of ARC. Because maybe I'll add my own reflection here a little bit, which is that, you know, the NFT industry, one of the major kind of like ideological drivers of the value of NFTs is a kind of capturing of memory, right? And the idea that like, you know, you are able to like own or kind of like commodify or even self-commodify an experience and have like a kind of a badge or a representation of that memory. And so I'm not sure whether that was part of your process, but it's definitely a resonant point for people who've been paying attention to that world.
I think for us, like, I mean, like, you know, I was aware of all this stuff that was happening. And I think that's just, that's like the NFT is the way it captures memory and the way data is commodified. That's just like a bigger, you know, that's like one segment of big data, right? And, you know, there's so many other ways that memories are captured kind of within kind of this like internet world. And I think we weren't particularly influenced by like crypto specifically, but definitely I see the parallels for anything that kind of exists in this like datafication, the commodification of datafication and within like that particular model.
Definitely. Yeah. And it's interesting too. The other thing that it made me think of is because there's this narrative in Union about the collapse of the nation state and then the rise of Gaia as like a kind of pseudo nation or something like that. And with the currency implications of that, like, you know, Facebook looking into Libra as cryptocurrencies. And so there's lots of, I think, interesting, interesting areas there that lines up.
Like, you know, in terms of like, just like corporations coming up with their own currency is kind of, you know, like even like Disneyland has like their own currency, right? So like, I think that's kind of like the first step to have like a, like to, for an entity to kind of like create like a different model or take some form of power outside of maybe current financial regulations.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So I wanted to go a little bit deeper into the role of memory in Union, because obviously this is a key theme and the quest, some of the complexities and questions about memory are center stage. So some critics have kind of seen the rise of social computation and social media as an extension and kind of inflation of the function of memory in our social life. So there's kind of more information being produced, it's collected, it's categorized, it's more than kind of any other time in human history. And you see, you know, in places like Europe, the question of like the right to be forgotten as expressed, you know, by the European GDPR, and that's kind of a key battleground in the politics of data. So from this perspective, it's interesting how Union emphasizes kind of a forgetting at the outset, where the present is defined by a kind of a radical loss of memory or a kind of amnesia. And I wanted to ask how you see this kind of initial forgetting of the Union world.
Yeah, I think a lot of our research and past research has been on the notion of cultural memory and sites of memory and activation of memory. And especially as to Asian people belonging to the diaspora, there is this sense of perhaps forgetting because we're not part of the home country. And we also realize how technology shapes cultural memory as well. So the idea of, for instance, when it comes to wedding dresses, how the history of a wedding dress is perhaps human-made, and these dresses are now mass-produced. And now that notion of what the dress means, normally maybe it would be passed down to different villages, has been lost. And now we see that, you know, people wear these fancy gowns and whatnot, and this is what we call the wedding industrial complex, for the gram, right? And so the idea of a wedding being a spiritual union in the past, or that meaning, is now lost. So that is kind of like a forgetting of memory, right? Like the actual deep-rooted spirituality of our ritualistic practices. And in this dystopic world, you can see that there is this stripping of memory because of how many years have gone by without us having access to all of this knowledge, and without this human activation of ritual and belonging. Because we really see that, I mean, for myself, right, like being a part of a community, being part of like an Indian community or Punjabi community where you're together, you're dancing, or you're having food together, those moments and those physicalities of bodies, emotions, and bodies together, that is what activates these memories. And this also forms new memories. Because, you know, I believe that each generation, no matter how much you try to kind of keep the same lineage of tradition, each generation is never going to be the same. It's just, it's not possible. You know, there's a lot of like gatekeeping and like policing of culture. But I do believe that, you know, we do have agency to create our own culture. And through each activation or movement, through these rituals that we do, we're actually cementing new memories into our bodies and creating new relationships with culture and cultural memory that we can pass on to the next generation.
I also want to point out, you know, within the Canadian history context, we suffer from a huge amount of amnesia, right? Like through Canadian history, mm-hmm. it's like all
yeah,
these
exactly.
things are just being recovered. So amnesia is like a tool to maintain political power. And, you know, it's kind of like it's like two sides of the same coin, you know, like when you're talking about like, you know, ways to preserve memory through social media and stuff like that, ways to preserve memory through media. It's part of the same coin, you know, by preserving certain things, you're also intentionally forgetting other things. And that's with like any kind of like, you know, historiography kind of study, you know, what history gets written and what history gets left out. And I think, you know, we have to think about, you know, the participation in, you know, social media in like archiving memories also as a participation as intentional amnesia.
Yeah, that's fascinating. It's interesting too, when I listen to both of your answers, there's a sense in which there's maybe different modes in which memory is preserved and forgotten or transmitted, right? Like on the one hand, we have this kind of like very, cognitive kind of datafied infrastructure for the preservation and or the supposed preservation and transmission of memory, which would be something like social media, which in effect has a kind of amnesic quality to it, even though it purports to be kind of a way of memorializing. And then on the other hand, we have this discussion of ritual, right? And this discussion of cultural lineages and the ways that they transmit and transform kind of across time. And I guess I was thinking a little bit about how in Union, what's emphasized at the beginning is the volatility of that first kind of memory, that digital memory, right? In contrast maybe with the ancestral memory or the ritualized memory that Kieran was just talking about.
Yeah, you're totally right. There's
different
modes of it.
Like no one can, I mean, I don't know, maybe in the future there'll be a way of like extracting it, but it's like, you know, how can you extract something through the lived body, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe somewhere down the line there's something that can do that.
Yeah.
And I think there's also the idea that memory is like an ever-changing thing, right? I think that the problem with this like digital extraction of memory is that it assumes that memory is stagnant, right? It kind of like flattens memory into this one-dimensional thing that exists as a stagnant moment in time, whereas memory is actually like a living spirit and a living thing that is always evolving and always changing with generations.
Right. It's like being kind of re-remembered and retold, and through that kind of process, adapting, changing, kind of modifying itself. Beautiful. So Nancy, in the artist statement for Union, you write, "The story Union tells is set in a distant post-apocalyptic future, precisely because my experience as a Taiwanese non-binary femme in the present feels so constricted that I felt it necessary to abandon the present world entirely." I'm wondering about this kind of gesture of abandoning the present, and how you see this in relation to the kind of the question of tradition that we were just talking about. Because on the one hand, there's this, it feels there's a movement of abandonment, but then there's also a deep reflection on the present in this work, and on the question of the past as well. So I was wondering how you see those two things articulated together.
Mm-hmm. I think that's kind of, you know, with any kind of like speculative fiction or any kind of conception of futurity, it's, I guess maybe abandonment is maybe too strong of a word, but, you know, you have to have some kind of departure, you know, but it's almost like a departure from the present in a way that you have to abandon anything you know of the present in order to create a sense or to envision a futurity that kind of exists. Because the present moment in the society that we currently live in, to create something, you know, within that container almost feels wrong and almost feels like it's too restrictive. So, you know, it's like abandoning something of the present moment. But obviously, you know, it's still the concept of the narrative and of the story is still, you know, it's still something we're projecting from the present moment. So, you know, obviously there's still a relationship. But I think, you know, with any kind of like futurism and, you know, talks of futurity is the idea that we're creating some form of utopia. And, you know, utopia is not like a time or not like a place. Utopia is something in action. There's a writer, can't remember the name of the book, but he writes about the blues and jazz, and how Black folks envision kind of like utopia within the action of playing jazz music. And, you know, like, I really think that's like super poetic in the sense that you're thinking about utopia as like an action of working towards something, of walking towards something, of singing, of dancing. And, you know, you have to enact an action in order for those portals of in order for a portal to utopia to open. And it's a fleeting thing. You know, as soon as you stop doing something, you kind of settle back into this reality. So, you know, I think about, you know, abandoning the present moment as a way to describe working in an action towards like opening a portal to utopia, but as a fleeting thing, because we always still have to return back to the present moment, but using that access to utopia, to that utopia moment, for us to reflect on what we can do better and inform what we can do better in the present.
Maybe that also gives us a bridge back to our discussion kind of around ritual, and even the question of the transition between worlds, right? Like when you brought up the jazz example, the first thing that immediately came to my mind was electronic music and the whole rave experience as another one of those kind of like time outside of time kind of places, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that like also like the embodiment element of that, right? Like it's kind of like a way of inhabiting this momentary utopia, which again reminds me of the whole union ritual in the piece.
Yeah, totally. Like the rave, the underground rave scene is a very good example of like a fleeting moment of utopia.
Yeah, and this collective experience too, like there's something to be said about, you know, collectively being together and collectively creating a memory that makes it even more real or more powerful because of the social relationship and interactions in that space.
Yeah, definitely. Actually, this is probably a good segue into the theme of embodiment in the work. There is a, you know, obviously there's this emphasis on intimacy, embodiment, touch as kind of the activation of this kind of ancestral memory, and also touch and embodiment as a mode of resistance against the forces that seek to commodify social relationships. And I was wondering how did you come to learn about this power? Are there kind of particular spaces like rave and music or other ones or practices that kind of embody this potential for both of you?
Yeah, I would say for me, one thing that I've been exploring in my artwork is very much this, the notion of recalling memory or creating new memory within my culture. So for me, my primary exploration was thinking about like, okay, what ties me to my memory? Like what ties me to my culture? What are things that make me feel rooted in my culture? And, you know, we talk about like food, we talk about like dancing. And one thing that really struck me was thinking about, cultural artifacts and sites of memory, and one of which being, textiles. And so I was thinking about specifically like my grandmother's textile, that when I, her shawl, when I wear it, I feel grounded in my culture. Like there is this kind of like sense of belonging that I get from wearing it. And through that process, I did a field research in Punjab where I was researching this specific textile called Fulkaris. And these ancestrally were, had different shapes and embroidery, from each village. And it was passed down from generation to generation. So a mother to a daughter, and then passed down to different villages. And when women are created these Fulkaris, you know, these are hand woven or hand embroidered. And so we see there that there's this movement, emotion, and this touch and feeling, and these memories get woven into the textile. And once they move from different villages, you see that the different embroideries, the motifs are then change based on the melding of two different villages together. And so I see how touch and movement is so powerful in shifting and transcending and communicating memories and creating new memories.
Yeah, it's interesting how, you know, your discussion there about the garment being passed down, it shows again how the kind of the various structures of kind of industrial production keep us alienated mm-hmm. from that kind of memory, right? Like I have no idea who created my shirt. You know, even if I buy vintage, you know, there's clearly a memory locked in this garment, but there's no way for me to kind of access it. Which yeah. defines, that's another way of thinking about maybe the amnesia that we were talking about before, is this mm-hmm. kind of like these like lost wandering objects that have no memory.
Absolutely. Yeah. And this particular textile too is mass produced now. It's machine made, you know, like it's rarely created by hand. And so now you see that, you know, people wear these textiles, you see them in pictures on Instagram and everywhere else, and then they're just put away. And so the memory that was once imbued on to this object has been lost. And that also shows how, you know, technology through like commodification, mass production, and machinery has also shifted this amnesia, as you were saying with the garments.
Yeah, just to go a little, like, to go on this a little bit longer, it's making me think also that, like, there's a question here of the intimacy of giving in a relationship, you know, that is also not there in most of the way that objects are circulated around our world.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like, because it's not relational, I don't know, I just think about, like, our relationship with food, right? When you grow something, you would have a different relationship than, you know, just going to the supermarket and just buying something, because you've been through the process of, you know, feeding this plant and taking care of it. So your relationship, relationships and relational dynamics then also, like, create new memories.
Yeah, and it shows how, like, the whole kind of idea that you could simulate or that you could purchase kind of, like, intimacy or memories is kind of there's a certain kind of illusoriness there, potentially, that, like, feeds the ideology of something like Gaia, but really what's happening is that the conditions for that have been somehow removed or made more difficult to find those spaces where you can actually access that kind of intimacy. So one of just to move into the question of kind of the formal structure of union, one of the things that really struck me was the vast array of kind of mediums and technical elements. You know, there's sculpture, there's film, there's immersive installation, there's composition. And I was wondering, just from a production side, like, how did you manage the creative process while working across so many mediums? And were you ever concerned about kind of, like, aesthetic or conceptual fragmentation, like, across the production tracks? Was this a challenge, or did it flow pretty organically through all those various forms?
You know, again, back to relationship, I don't think that was ever a concern for us. Like, we did have a huge team to develop this project. Obviously, we had, like, multiple departments, like audio, visual departments. We had, you know, branding. You know, we had, like, the sculpture. We had, like, this digital visual assets and things like that. But I think one of the true kind of, like, beauty of the project union was, like, the union of, like, all of us and our friends. Because, you know, this was a project that we had to do throughout the pandemic, like, deep in the pandemic in 2020, 2021. So that world was very different. You know, it was, you know, we didn't really have access to kind of social spaces, you know, so the project itself functioned as, like, a social space for all the people that were partaking in the production of this project. So, you know, I think, like, the working dynamic and the way that, and I think this is, like, true for all of our projects that Kira and I, we kind of do, you know, we don't believe that it's worth, like, it's not worth sacrificing your relationship for some kind of creative output, you know, that is consumed by somebody else, you know. So a lot of the things and the content and the kind of visual and audio elements that were created in this project, we give a lot of agency to our collaborators in making something that makes them feel good, because as artistic directors on a project, we have the power to reconceptualize our narrative and reconceptualize our story to fit the needs of all the collaborators in the project.
Yeah, I would say we're very reflexive in that way. And for us, you know, it's really, of course, we, you know, we are concerned about the product, but at the same time, we find more beauty and more learning and whatnot through the process. And I think that is something that we primarily focus on, is, you know, developing and deepening relationships with our current collaborators or bringing on new collaborators. Yeah.
It's interesting to think about having to produce something like that during the pandemic, and
yeah, it was insane.
Yeah. Because it's also, like, you know, if union, especially the dystopic and Gaia levels, are reflections kind of our, you know, entrapment by social media, it must have felt pretty real as you were working on it to be kind of contained to those channels, the channels that were kind of given in that moment?
Absolutely. I think I remember there was a moment where Nancy and I were, I don't know if we were rehearsing, and I remember thinking like, wow, we're the only people in this room that can be this close to one another. That we're allowed to be this close to one another, you know?
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
true. We're able to break the 2 meter
and be
rule.
Intimate. Yeah.
Wow. When I was kind of looking into both your backgrounds, I noticed that you both work across like a range of practices similar to the range of mediums that Union employs. And I was wondering whether, you know, with your first project kind of explicit world building that Union was, has this experience of taking world building as an aesthetic kind of object or ideal, has it impacted the way that you view other domains of your work in life? Like has it had the reflections that you've had on like what a world is and the details of worlds, has that influenced you at all?
Oh, totally. I think I've been world building like for a long time, you know, just maybe not in like a speculative fiction way, but you know, as like a community organizer, like a cultural producer, as an event producer, as someone that hosts events like raves, as someone that runs like current feminist electronic art symposium, the goal and the vision is world building through, you know, artistic programming and through kind of space making, right? Like you're trying to make a space and trying to create an artistic program and create certain discourses that can move towards a future that you want to see.
I guess another kind of thing that I was thinking about was, you know, since its appearance kind of last year at Richmond Art Gallery, the world of Union has kind of begun to migrate into a web XR experience, which I believe is going to be shown at Mutex Virtual Exhibition. And I wanted to ask like about this decision to adapt the project in this way. And maybe just, I'm wondering how designing for physical space is different than virtual space, and kind of what's exciting to you about this kind of web XR format?
I think what's really, you know, well, first of all, we don't have to have white gallery walls, because that was something that we really wanted to immerse people in a space and feel like they're, you know, you're not in a gallery, you're actually inhabiting these worlds. And I think what the WebXR experience does is it offers us this displacement or this new opportunity to take artwork outside of a gallery space, which in itself has its own histories and yeah, there's a lot there, you know, when you walk into a gallery space. And so it, I don't know, it's almost like it creates it's a more neutral space in a sense, and where participants can feel even more immersed, because in the gallery space, you get a sense of our characters in the space and the story of Union. And what this WebXR experience does is it offers us the participants the notion of actually inhabiting these spaces and interacting with Gaia and creating social interaction in that space.
Yeah, we think the WebXR, I mean, obviously, the WebXR space or just any kind of XR space is a better medium for world building than perhaps mm-hmm. a gallery space. Because, you know, the gallery space has a lot of, you know, it's like,
has a lot of limitations.
Yeah, and also, you know, there's like physical limitations, you know, whether
yeah.
that's like physics, you know, of like installing things, or, you know, institutional limitations within a gallery space too, a bureaucratic or institutional limitations of what you can do in the space.
Yeah, I feel like this is one of the interesting kind of tensions or complexities about media art or doing kind of XR art, is that on the one hand, it feels like it gives a whole plane of creativity that is unbound in compared to certain kind of physical spaces. But on the other hand, you know, if we're thinking about some of the kind of the visions of of creativity that are being put forward by people like who are working at Meta or in the broader kind of like VR metaverse kind of space. There's also something about, I think, that Union calls us to around the physical space and world building in the physical space as well. And so there's this kind of complexity, I think, about the status of reality and virtual reality and those constraints as well.
Yeah, for sure.
Another thing I wanted to ask you both about was that it feels that in kind of the trajectory of your work, there's an exploration of this kind of concept of immersion and of immersive art. So often foregrounding the relationship between kind of this viewer and their sensory environment. And I wanted to ask if you could just tell me a little bit about how you see this concept of immersion, what's really important in creating an immersive experience for a participant or a viewer.
Karen, what's that guy's name? We were just talking about this. What's the guy's name that taught that audio workshop? I'm just trying to remember. Like, there's a guy. I'm just trying to get his name
right. I don't
right.
know.
This guy that taught the audio workshop, and he has this really amazing thing that he says about.
At IM4?
At IM4, yeah. Yeah.
I can't remember. What was the quote? I can't even remember.
Oh, he just kind of gave, he's an indigenous like sound designer, and then he talked about immersion through the story of like how the world was created, and all he said was like, just close your eyes and like I'm gonna tell you the story of creation, and that was immersion.
Wow.
Like that was virtual reality, like just close mm-hmm. your eyes and just let me tell you the story of creation. And and that was like, that was his kind of introduction to like, we taught like a VR workshop together, and he was like, that is kind of like the most raw form of like a virtual reality, just listening to a story and just imagining, like that immersion itself is enough.
Wow, that's beautiful.
Just trying to find his name.
Yeah, why do we do what we do?
Well, yeah, and I think this is one of the places that I was kind of thinking that I wanted to go with this question, is that it feels in some way that all art calls us to a kind of immersion, right? And then some of the technical mediums like XR and some of the mixed reality stuff that you both work on is like it's a development of this, and is allowing for kind of more tools for engaging participants and really bringing them into a piece of artwork.
I just found his name. It's Quinn Brander.
Great.
Shout out.
Shout out, Quinn.
Sweet.
Sorry, your last question.
No, I was just thinking about, you know, what differentiates kind of immersive art from just art in general, right? And it made me feel a little bit like, you know, I feel like most art actually calls for an experience of immersion, especially when it's effective in engaging its participants. Mm-hmm. And maybe we just have better tools that are, you know, creating more and more kind of immersive experiences for artists to kind of experiment with.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's not really, I feel like it's like not a, people get so tied up with like rules and like technology and all this stuff. And I think that's what's so beautiful, what Quinn Brander said about like immersion was so beautiful, because it's like, you don't need a computer, you don't need a VR headset, you can just like listen to a story, and that itself is immersion. To kind of remind us like the simplicity of immersion and how we already have access to the tools of immersion without any of this fancy technology stuff. And sometimes I think we get too wrapped up and like, okay, we need like the Oculus Rift S to like be the most immersive thing, and 8K video, you know, 360 video and stuff like that. But it's like you said, you know, like, you know, like some art has the ability to create immersion even without any of these tools. And I think, you know, what really creates immersion through art is its ability to connect with its audience or its viewer. Mm-hmm. And I guess maybe that's the difference between good art and bad art. You know, ones that you really feel and ones that you just don't, you know? And like everyone
yeah,
has
like,
a different mm-hmm. taste and perspective.
Yeah, and almost displacing the sense of place and time. And
yeah.
In creating that immersion And that is what creates good art.
I truly believe any medium can create immersion. And that is not something that is like grasped with like through like fancy technology. Because I've definitely experienced VR works where, you know, I'm like literally in a headset. But like the work itself was like not immersive for me. You know, like I wanted the whole time I was in the VR experience, I wanted to get out. I was thinking about how to get out to the VR experience. So I couldn't pay attention to the experience. So
yeah,
like I think it really depends on the work itself and what the work is trying to say and how the work kind of connects to someone emotionally or spiritually.
This is Democracy Now! In an unprecedented move, the FBI has executed a search warrant on former President Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort in Florida. The raid is reportedly tied to a federal probe into Trump's unlawful removal of documents from the White House. We'll get the latest. Then we look at the Senate's sweeping $739 billion bill to address the climate crisis, reduce drug costs, and establish a 15% minimum tax for large corporations.
The Senate has now passed the most significant bill to fight the climate crisis ever. And it's going to make a difference to my grandkids. The world will be a better place for my grandchildren because of what we did today. And that makes me feel very, very good.
We'll speak to Rob Weissman of Public Citizen, Indigenous land defender Tara Hauska, and Bishop William Barber. We'll also speak to the bishop about why he wants to go to Russia to help free basketball superstar Brittany Griner. And we'll look at the trial of